Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
All right, so what is anti-American and what is pro-American? What does this mean, anti-American? Let's talk about this for a while. I'm particularly curious. I know we have a lot of international listeners, and I know it's very hard to call into the show. But if you're listening internationally, I'm curious if in your country you hear people, you know, politicians arguing about, he's anti-Swiss, I'm pro-Swiss, he's anti-Canadian, I'm pro-Canadian. Do we hear these kind of phrases? Do you hear these kind of phrases internationally? I know this is something that, the Nazis used very heavily in 32 and in 34. But I don't know how much, to what extent is this just demagoguery? By the way, welcome to our show. Tom Hartman here with you. Terry Jeffrey is going to be with us in our second hour. In our third hour, John Dean is going to drop by. We've got a great, 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 great program today. But this question, what is anti-American? Congressman Robin Hayes, for example, the Republican from North Carolina. Now, he has since apologized for this comment, and that, much to his credit. But saying it in the first place, this is Congressman Hayes as he's whipping up a crowd for Sarah Palin.
Sarah Palin, she's a lady that can get her done. She's been in Alaska. She got her did. Folks, there's a real American. Liberals hate real Americans that work and accomplish and achieve and believe in God. That's a great comparison.
Now, this is basically what Rush Limbaugh has been saying for 16 years. Literally saying liberals hate America. Here's Michelle Bachmann on Chris Matthews, and she has not apologized. In fact, she's come out and said, Chris tricked me into answering this question.
Usually we associate with people who have similar ideas to us, and it seems that it calls into question what Barack Obama's true beliefs and values and thoughts are. You got Harry Reid, who's liberal, Nancy Pelosi,
right,
who's liberal.
You have a troika of the most leftist
administration in the history of our country.
If you have liberal views, does that mean you have anti-American views? What's the connection? I don't get the connection. What's the connection between liberal and leftist? Anti-American.
Anti-American is the point. The liberals that are Jeremiah Wright and that are Bill Ayers, they're over the top anti-American. Remember, it was Michelle Obama who said she's only recently proud of her country. And so these are very anti-American views.
Barack Obama may have anti-American views.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm very concerned that he may have anti-American views.
What about people like Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid, the liberals you were mentioning a moment ago? Where would you put them? Would you consider them anti-American as well?
I would consider them to have far leftist views.
Yeah, you put three words together, liberal, leftist, and anti-American. How do they all fit together, those three terms?
I think the people that Barack Obama has been associating with are anti-American by and large.
How many do you suspect of your colleagues as being anti-American?
What I would say is that the news media should do a penetrating expose and take a look. I wish they would. I wish the American media would take a great look at the views of the people in Congress and find out, are they pro-America or anti-America? I think people would love to see an expose like that.
So Michelle Bachmann talking about anti-American. This is the predominant meme right now. This is the predominant clip. And, there have been times when I've actually felt in a glib moment that maybe Bush and Cheney were anti-American because they've been pursuing policies that have fundamentally hurt this country. But does that mean that they hate this country? Does that mean that they want to harm this country? Does that mean that they don't like this country? I have to honestly say, I don't think so. I really don't think so. I don't think that there is, perhaps there's a small fringe in this country who, and I'm talking about, maybe just a couple thousand people in the entire country. I don't know. But in the political mainstream, people who are volunteering for political office, people who are putting themselves out there, people in the media and people in the mainstream, I don't think that any of them are anti-American. I think what we're seeing are contrasting views, contrasting pro-American views, people who love their country, who believe in this country, and simply have a different idea of how this country should be run. And I think Colin Powell laid this out so eloquently when he talked about this. And I, let me just play this clip. This is Colin Powell talking about the thing that finally pushed him over the edge to endorse Barack Obama.
I feel strongly about this particular point because of a picture I saw in a magazine. It was a photo essay about troops who are serving in Iraq and Afghanistan. And one picture at the tail end of this photo essay was of a mother in Arlington Cemetery. And she had her head on the headstone of her son's grave. And as the picture focused in, you could see the writing on the headstone. And it gave his awards, Purple Heart, Bronze Star, showed that he died in Iraq, gave his date of birth, date of death. He was 20 years old. And then at the very top of the headstone, it didn't have a Christian cross. It didn't have a Star of David. It had a crescent and a star of the Islamic faith. And his name was Karim Rashad Sultan Khan. And he was an American. He was born in New Jersey. He was 14 years old at the time of 9/11. And he waited until he can go serve his country, and he gave his life. Now, we have got to stop polarizing ourselves in this way. And John McCain is as non-discriminatory as anyone I know. But I'm troubled about the fact that within the party, we have these kinds of expressions.
He's kind of anti, you know, calling people anti-American. And, you know, in 1999... I was invited to spend a week with a group of people from the Association for Global New Thought, AGNT, with His Holiness the Dalai Lama at his home in Dharamsala, India. And I went, and there were, you know, 30 of us or 40 of us all together, about 20 of us who were sitting with His Holiness and actually in conversation every day for 5 days, and or every afternoon, a half day. And the mission statement was, how do we create a world that works? And I remember there was this big debate among us, among many in the group were Americans, not all, but most, among us about whether or not we should endorse a boycott against Chinese goods, because Chinese were decimating Tibet. You know, they'd killed over 1 million Tibetans, and they have enslaved that nation, His Holiness's nation. And finally, after 2 days of basically infighting among ourselves, we came to the conclusion that we would do that. We would offer His Holiness that we would spearhead. I mean, among the 30 of us or so, we figured that we probably had 30, 40 million people who read our books or listened to us or whatever. And so we got together with him and we said, Your Holiness, we will lead a boycott. And he said, would your actions result in an increase in poverty and the possible death, starvation and death of children in China? And one of the members of the group had been one of the leaders of the South African boycott back in the 80s and said, yes, in fact, that's what happened in South Africa. Thousands of people died as a consequence of the economic sanctions. And His Holiness said, well, in that case, I cannot endorse this. And, you know, in my mind, I had always had like this little circle in the sand, me and my family and my friends and people who think like me are on the inside and everybody else is on the outside. There's a us and there's a them. And the Dalai Lama came along and just with his little whisk broom swept away that circle and said, sorry, there's no us, there's no them, it's all us. It's all us, it's all the we. And this is what Dwight Eisenhower talked about when he said, let us not become, this was in his, as he was leaving office, he said, let us not become a nation of dreadful fear and hate.
During a long lane of the history yet to be written, America knows that this world of ours, ever growing smaller, must avoid becoming a community of dreadful fear and hate, and be instead a proud confederation of mutual trust and respect. Together we must learn how to compose differences, not with arms, but with intellect and decent purpose.
And decent purpose. And this is a statement, you know, by a Republican saying, no, we're not going to talk about anti-American. We're not going to attack We're not going to say, you know, these people are less than American. You know, Dale Carnegie in his book, How to Win Friends and Influence People, talked about Two Gun Crowley, this notorious bank robber. And he was finally trapped and he was gunned down. And as he was dying, a reporter got to him and said, "What do you have to say, Two Gun Crowley?" And the guy said, "All I ever tried to do was help people." I mean, the bottom line is that all behavior has at its core a desire for a positive outcome. All behavior. And we have to understand that, that there's not anti-Americans and pro-Americans among us. There are these contrasting views. What does anti-American mean to you? What does it mean to be anti-American? I'm going to share some thoughts from a few other Americans about being anti-American. The only person I know of in this entire race right now, in the entire American political scene, who arguably is anti-American, would be Todd Palin, who wants to secede from America.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Knock on mama's door. If they can't build cars like their fathers did, you can sign your kids up for the war. From Texas towns to California, from the Gulf to the Pacific, the contract's out to build a wall. This land is our land, don't forget it. And the Walmarts filled the towns, the golden arches in between. But now there's houses in the fields, the farm is wasted by the big machine. And the gas is sold $3 a gallon, and we all stop off to get our fill. And the air we breathe will be the price to be the fat man on the hill. The fat man.
It's all of our America. 21 minutes past the hour, 22 minutes past the hour now. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where we say better voter turnout means fewer elected Republicans. Be smart. Vote. Get out there and participate. I would go so far as to say that Bill Ayers was not anti-American. When he was in the Weather Underground, he was doing it because he loved his country and he wanted to change it for what he believed was the better. That Tim McVeigh was not anti-American. When he killed several hundred Americans in this criminal, crazy, misguided attempt, he did so because he wanted to create what he believed was a better nation. Now, I'm not praising that. I'm condemning it. But I think it's really important that we understand the motivation of people. If they're not calling for absolute destruction of the entire country or secession from the country, how can we say somebody is anti-American? I don't get it. I just don't get it. Claudio in Toronto, Canada. Hey, Claudio.
Hey, how are you, Tom?
Just great. Thank you for calling.
I'm a political junkie, and I've been watching your election for the last year and a half. Actually, I've watched every election since I was 18. And I'm 45, and I have to tell you, since I was 18 till now, there has not been one Canadian election where either party has ever, ever commented on the other party being non-Canadian.
And so anti-Canadian is just a phrase that doesn't exist in the Canadian political lexicon.
No. And we are made up of the same fabric as American citizens, except there's one thing that's different. You have one party, I hate to say, promotes racism, promotes separation, does not like Americans knowing what the rest of the world thinks and how they act accordingly to certain things, their economic principles, their military principles, all these other things. They like keeping them ignorant. Yeah. Now, if you have to say which party is that, I'm sure most people would say it's the Republicans. And being an outsider, I don't have a dog in this game. So being an outsider, I can tell you, one party knows its own survival is based on them keeping their base that way.
Yeah.
That's why they don't want education. That's why they don't want to subsidize education. Sure. If they all become intelligent.
Smart voters are not Republican voters. But in Canada, you have the, is it called the Québécois?
Yes.
You have a party in Quebec that is actually calling for Quebec to secede from the rest of Canada. Are they called anti-Canadians?
No. They're French.
They're
a minority.
So, yeah, but the point is that they're not vilified. There's a disagreement.
That doesn't make you anti-Canadian. When we had the referendum a few years ago, they had a rally in downtown Montreal, which drew 500,000 people on a business day. It wasn't a weekend. And we had a 300 by 150-foot flag open up just to show Quebecers that we are still one, regardless if they want to separate or not.
Right.
And because of that, we, the nationalists, won the election, or that referendum. We don't have ill will to them.
Yeah, right. So
you have to move ahead of this.
Yep. Claudio, thank you very much for sharing that with us. I appreciate it, and thank you very much for the call.
Love your show.
Thank you, Claudio.
Take care.
And thanks for listening on the web. Paul in Dallas, Texas. Hey, Paul. Paul, you're a Canadian?
Yeah, I'm a Canadian actually living in a red state, believe it or not.
Okay. Must be a weird experience.
So I do have both points of view where I travel to Europe a lot. So one thing I've observed is there's definitely two groups of Americans. There are some Americans who travel internationally for work or for leisure or whatever. They have one point of view. But I do notice that a lot of Americans don't travel.
Yeah.
And they lack that global
point of view. I think fewer than 5%
of
Americans have a passport, as I recall.
I'm sorry, what was that percentage?
Fewer than 5% of Americans have a passport.
Yeah. So you know, when you hear the politicians saying, you know, the U.S. is number one in this, they're, you know, we're the freest country in the world, if you really look at the indexes, you know, the U.S. is not number one when it comes to economic freedom or freedom of the press, government transparency, healthcare, education, infrastructure. And I think when you travel internationally, you see that. You see, wow, look how they're doing it in this country. Maybe we can learn from them.
Right.
And the problem is when you come back to the U.S. and you start talking about that, you're seen as un-American.
I try to tell people about the time we were in England, and I was giving a speech, and our Louise and our youngest were with me, and our youngest at that time was homeschooling, and she was like 14. And she had just a god-awful ear infection. And I got back from the speech around 11 o'clock at night, and we called down to the local surgery, which is the phrase in England for the local doctor's office, and said, you know, our daughter's got an ear infection, what should we do? And the guy said, I'll be right over. And he came over at 11:30 at night to this house, and we all, you know, walked into the bedroom where Kareth was in bed, and he looks in her ear, and he says, oh, yeah, she's got an ear infection, gives her some antibiotics and leaves. I said, what do I owe you? He says, nothing. You tell people that story, and they go, what, are you crazy? Paul, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Some thoughts from Ronald Reagan when we come back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
A shout out to T. Gene in the chat room. Your son's trying to get in touch with you. Turn your phone on. We deliver some strange messages here, but T. Gene in the chat room, your son is trying to call you, and your phone is turned off, and you probably don't know it. So your husband just sent me a note in the chat room. You can drop into the chat room, by the way, at TomHartman.com if you want. I'm in there every day hanging out, and you can see our live video stream, TomHartman.com. There's a link to it over at AirAmerica.com. 34 minutes past the hour, the Tom Hartman Program, the place where smart people get their news. Okay, this is incredible. In England, a guy broke into a woman's house, 91-year-old woman's house, at 4 o'clock in the morning, and she confronted him, and it scared the hell out of her. So the next day, he sent her flowers and an apology for breaking in. In New Zealand, a burglar visited a home in New Zealand twice in one day. First to steal some goods, and later to return them along with a heartfelt apology note. He smashed a window, took a laptop, a camera, a wallet, an American Express card, returned later in the day along with a new basketball and two pairs of gloves bought on the stolen credit card, and an apology. He says, I have never written truer words when I say I wish I had never done this to you and your family. From the bottom of my heart, I am sorry. Isn't that sweet? You know, why don't we have burglars like that in the United States? I don't know. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Theodore in Vancouver, Washington. You want to suggest that I'm anti-American, eh?
Of course you know that I've said that in the past. I mean, you're usually arguing the case for Russia, which is, you know, a KGB-led totalitarian kind of corporate operation. And, you know,
well, I'm not a fan of the government of Russia, but I'm...
But you're a fan of Pravda and et cetera, et cetera.
Well, actually, I was on Russian television last week. If you go to the Russian television site, you can see an interview I did. They flew out here and interviewed me. So I guess that makes me a come on, Theodore, give me a break.
Let's laugh about this. You had a couple of Kanukistanis on talking about America when it's really it's a core issue. It's an American issue.
So
and
Theodore,
what you guys...
Do you think that there are anti-American politicians? Do you think that anybody who really puts enough effort into running for political office to try and make this country better, whether they believe that making this country better means privatizing Social Security or strengthening Social Security, do you think that they're anti-American?
Tom, I think that there is a huge globalist powerhouse really vying for power in the country.
Are you talking about the people who want us all to join the World Trade Organization and turn our sovereignty over to multinational corporations?
Absolutely. Okay, so
you're talking about the Republican Party then?
You're saying that the Republican Party
and the advocates of free trade and I guess you could toss Bill Clinton into that category are anti-American. Is that your point?
Tom, what I was just going to say is who signed NAFTA. But Tom, this is the thing. What you guys and what the two-snakehead parties really advocate is you want to reduce this country to a bunch of squabbling nationalities, which of course Theodore Roosevelt was against. And I think we're well
on the path. I don't want to, and that's the whole point of my rant. That's where I'm saying I'm not going to be calling anybody, including you, Theodore, anti-American. I think we're all in this together. I think we all love our country. I think that that's a really positive statement. Consider here. This is Ronald Reagan back in 1948. The Republicans had controlled Congress for 2 years. They took control of Congress in 46, in the election of 46, and they passed the Smoot-Hawley Act. They rolled back the protections on labor. They did away with some of the protections on wages and prices. And this is Ronald Reagan campaigning. And just listen carefully. He never even implies that his opponents are anti-American.
The profits of corporations have doubled, while workers' wages have increased by only one quarter. In other words, profits have gone up four times as much as wages. And the small increase workers did receive was more than eaten up by rising prices, which have also bored into their savings. For example, here's an Associated Press dispatch I read the other day about Smith L. Carpenter, a craftsman in Union Springs, New York. Seems that Mr. Carpenter retired some years ago, thinking he had enough money saved up so that he could live out his last years without having to worry.
Listen carefully.
But he didn't figure on this Republican inflation, which ate up all his savings, and so he's gone back to work. The reason this is news is Mr. Carpenter is 91 years old. Now, take as a contrast the Standard Oil Company of New Jersey, which reported a net profit of $210 million after taxes for the first half of 1948. An increase of 70% in 1 year. In other words, high prices have not been caused by higher wages, but by bigger and bigger profits.
Bingo.
The Republican promises sounded pretty good in 1946. But what has happened since then, since the 80th Congress took over? Prices have climbed to the highest level in history, although the death of the OPA was supposed to bring prices down through, quote, the natural process of free competition, unquote. Labor has been handcuffed for the vicious Taft-Hartley law. Social Security benefits have been snatched away from almost 1 million workers by the Gearhart bill. Fair employment practices, which had worked so well during wartime, have been abandoned. Veterans' pleas for low-cost homes have been ignored, and many people are still living in made-over chicken coops and garages. Tax reduction bills have been passed to benefit the higher income brackets alone. The average worker saved only $1.73 a week. In the false name of economy, millions of children have been deprived of milk once provided through the federal school lunch program. This was the payoff of the Republicans' promises. And this is why we must have new faces in the Congress of the United States, Democratic faces. This is why we must elect not only President Truman, but also men like Mayor Hubert Humphrey of Minneapolis, the Democratic candidate for senator from Minnesota.
Ronald Reagan, 1948, and I don't recall him calling anybody anti-American. Is it Leb in Buckley, Washington?
That's correct, sir.
Hey, Leb, what's up?
Well, first, good to be on the air with you, Tom. I've listened to your show for quite a while.
Thanks, Leb.
And I am a disenfranchised voter, and I wanted to say, you know, the Senate did this a while ago. If this congressperson is so worried about anti-American or un-American activities, why don't we do it in the House? Why don't we have a House committee on un-American activities?
Well, we actually did.
That sounds familiar at all?
Yeah, the HUAC is what it was called, House Un-American Activities Committee. Yeah, so you're suggesting that Michelle Bachmann and Joe McCarthy seem to have a lot in common.
And, that is correct.
Yeah, exactly. And that's where this kind of thing goes. It goes to terrorizing people. It's such a shame. Marvin in Dallas, Texas. You're from Zimbabwe, Marvin.
Yes, I'm from Zimbabwe.
Your thoughts? Do you hear anti-Zimbabwean?
Yeah, no, actually, Tom, I'm seeing is exactly what, you know, our government was duly elected by the people.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't just overnight become a dictatorship.
Yeah, Mr. Obote. Originally, he was pretty much a hero and a very, very bright guy. I think he just kind of went crazy over time.
Yeah. But when we started, you know, labeling other citizens with these names of traitor, treason, because, you know, you criticized the policies, and we started having a dictatorship of the people on other citizens. And as a result, now we got a fully-fledged dictatorship, and even the people who actually were supporting Robert Mugabe can't even control him now.
Right. So when Milton Obote, are you suggesting, Marvin, that when Milton Obote became a dictator, when he became insane, I think he became mentally ill, that the symptom of it was that he started calling people anti-Zimbabwean, calling them traitors?
Yeah, calling other citizens traitors.
Yeah.
Okay. And I'll tell you what happened again. Those people were calling other citizens traitors and guilt of treason. Then the government began to, you know, reward them through appointments to big positions and rewarding. You know, basically what I'm seeing here, these are the symptoms that we get in third world countries. And we hold America as a beacon of democracy. And now you got Mugabe coming to the United Nations and telling the American president that who are you to tell me that I'm a dictator when your hands are dripping with blood? And now we worry a lot because then we won't have anyone to turn to with, you know, these presidents in third world countries see what is happening in America. You know, we can't even get rid of now from power after he lost the election.
Right.
You see. And really, I think Americans should pause and take a serious look at where they want to go.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Marvin. Thank you very much for the call. And you know, as far as anti-American goes, this is about as close as I can get to it. This is the founder of the Alaskan Independence Party, which Todd Palin was a member of up until 2002, and which Sarah Palin supports. This sounds anti-American to me.
The fires of hell are frozen glaciers compared to my hatred for the American government. And I won't be buried under their damn flag. I'll be buried in Dawson. And when Alaska is an independent nation, they can bring my bones home, back to my country.
Now, that even goes beyond the rhetoric that I hear from the Québécois, from the folks, the French in Quebec who want to secede from Canada. They don't call Canada the damn country, they, at least that I've seen. I mean, when we lived in Vermont, we got CBC News, we got Canadian News, and we used to watch it regularly. And what I heard from the secessionists was that they just thought that they could do it better with their own language and their own, you know, French language and French culture. It wasn't that they hated the rest of Canada. Joe Vogler actually hated America.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
Hey, George, I'm talking to you. You're bringing me disgrace, pretending to be my president. You were never even elected in the first place. Spending all of my money on that really ugly war and lying to everybody about the reasons that it's for. Well, it's oil money, George. It's been that way right from the start. Petroleum Bonaparte. Hey, George, what's the body count? Does anybody know? When the brown and foreign, do you bother or do you just let them go? And when the coffins come back home with our daughters and our sons, you think the families give them a medal and ask for another one? Well, it's kind of cold that way, isn't it, George? It's been that way right from the start.
Welcome back to the True People's Radio. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And, by the way, it was not Milton Obote. He was the ultimately, the primarily the dictator, and then later the dictator of, although he was elected both times, of Uganda. In fact, when Dick Gregory and I were in Uganda in 1981, as I recall, we got bounced out of a hotel because Obote was traveling around the country running for re-election, and they needed our room for him. He showed up with a little caravan of jeeps with five-gallon gas cans tied all over the back of them, way, way, way high, you know, traveling around the country. And so I had Obote in my mind. It's Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe. So, and a tip of the hat to the folks in the chat room for refreshing my memory on that. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Adam in Emeryville, California. Hey, Adam.
Hi. So I'm a Canadian living in California. Mm-hmm. I've been living down here for about 4 years, so I've been down here during two Canadian elections, and I've definitely never in my life heard, you know, one Canadian party refer to another as anti-Canadian. But my main comment was about actually anti-American, pro-American. I was watching the third debate, and I heard McCain something to the effect of, if you like Obama's health plan, then you'll really love Canada or England. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to share with everyone that, you know, I have an employee-sponsored healthcare plan down here that's supposedly comprehensive, and I've paid more for healthcare in the last 3 weeks than I have in my entire life.
In Canada?
Yeah,
you've paid more in the last 3 weeks here in the United States than you have in your entire life in Canada?
Yeah.
Because of co-pays and deductibles and things?
I'm sorry?
Because of co-pays and deductibles on your insurance?
Co-pays and deductibles, and also my insurance likes to play a little trick where they say that a consultation or some sort of appointment is not really worth what the doctor charged for it, so they will only pay you a certain amount.
Yeah. Amazing. Yeah. Adam, thanks a lot for that. I appreciate the call. Good to hear from you. Tom in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, Tom.
Hey, Tom. Real quick here, this week's cover of Time magazine shows four presidents, Franklin Roosevelt, Barack Obama, McCain, and President Lincoln, with the caption, "Does temperament matter?" And I'm just wondering, because last week Time cover was a photograph of the soup lines during the Republican Great Depression, and I'm wondering, with these comments of socialists and communists thrown at Obama, since that's what they called Franklin Roosevelt and his wife, Eleanor, when is the Obama campaign going to start invoking the legacy, saying, yeah, that's what you guys called the greatest president of the 20th century, a communist, and he rescued us from the last Republican Great Depression, and just throw it right back at him?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. It very well said, Tom, and thank you. And in memory of your calling in, Franklin Roosevelt.
Economic royalists complain that we seek to overthrow the institutions of America.
See, they call him anti-American.
What they really complain of is that we seek to take away their power.
And then he points out that he's a real American.
Our allegiance.
Our allegiance to American democracy.
And our allegiance to American institutions requires the overthrow of this kind of power.
You get that? It requires the overthrow of this kind of power. In fact, Roosevelt went on to say,
in vain they seek to hide behind the flag and the Constitution.
But what they forget is that we're all Americans here, what they stand
but
for.
But in their blindness, they forget what the flag and the Constitution stand for.
And they stand for protection from both mob rule and the overprivileged alike.
Now, as always, for over a century and a half, the flag, the Constitution, stand against a dictatorship by mob rule and the overprivileged alike. And the flag and the Constitution stand for democracy, not tyranny, for freedom, not subjection.
So it's all about what we're for, and let's stop calling each other anti-American. It's really simple. Carolyn in San Francisco. Hey, Carolyn.
Hi, I just want to disagree with you to some degree. I imagine the Bush family descending from the Tories that wished that the Jefferson, et cetera, had not prevailed in the Revolution, because Bush made a comment about the Constitution being like a piece of paper, and here's Barack Obama, a constitutional scholar, so I'm sure he loves something about America, but...
Yeah, we don't know if Bush actually, you know, made that comment, but the fact of the matter is that he and Cheney are not showing a lot of respect for the Constitution. As I said, I think that they have a different vision of America. They have a vision of an America that is basically a plutocracy, you know, where a few plutocratic families and people of great wealth and people of nobility run the country, and all the rest of us just say, yes, sir, yes, sir. But that doesn't mean that they hate the country. That doesn't mean that they're anti-American. They may be anti-constitutional.
But what does America mean to you? To me, it's the Bill of Rights, which they've plundered. It's caring about everybody. It's equal access to education and all that. And to them, it seems to be we get on top and we take all your money.
Yeah. These are the dueling interpretations of the Constitution, Carolyn. You have conservatives who say, well, the Constitution didn't say that you can have a Department of Education and that you should have free public education, so therefore you shouldn't. And then you have
people. But what about
like
de Tocqueville? De Tocqueville was amazed by the education. The average American farmer could quote Shakespeare.
Yes.
I mean, what happened?
Well, what happened is Ronald Reagan came into office. You heard the great clip in 48. I mean, he was a good Democrat then. And then he married Nancy Davis, and her father sat him down and said, son, you want to be successful, you want to be powerful, you want to be president someday, you want to be rich, join me and become a Republican. And he did. 57, but he didn't. He still didn't become anti-American.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Terry Jeffrey is with us. He's the editor-in-chief of CNSNews.com. You can keep tab on all the right-wing news of the daily e-brief from CNSNews.com, should you be so inclined. Hey, Terry.
Hey, Paul.
Hey, I heard a spot you guys are running on a competing radio station here in town. Tired of the liberal bias? So you can get the real news over at CNSNews. You ought to advertise on our show.
Well, it's a possibility, Tom. We'll have to think about it. We have a limited budget, but those are the first radio ads we've ever run. And by the way, what we're trying to do is get people to sign up for our e-brief, which has us emailing to them each day our exclusive stories on CNSNews.com. So if Tom Hartman listeners want to sign in, they'll see what we're reporting every day.
I just plugged it for you.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. I'm curious about your take on anti-Americanism. We just had this discussion the entire first hour. I got a bunch of callers on this topic as well. I don't, frankly, even think that Tim McVeigh was anti-American. I deplore what he did. He was a criminal. He was crazed. But he thought that he was creating a better America. I think you could argue that maybe Joe Vogler, who came right out and said he hates America and he won't be buried in America, is anti-American, the guy who founded the Alaska Independence Party. But that's the rare exception. And I don't, I've had a bunch of Canadians call in. I had a guy call in from Zimbabwe saying, you know, the guy from Zimbabwe said that when Mugabe went over the edge, when he went around the rail and they started killing people, was when they started calling people traitors, calling them anti-Zimbabweans. I mean, this kind of rhetoric is just so wrong. What's going on inside your party?
Well, first of all, I think Tim McVeigh clearly was anti-American. He blew up the U.S. Federal Building and murdered a bunch of people.
He was a criminal.
But it was an anti-American crime he committed. He blew up a U.S. Federal Building, murdered innocent people. He was attempting to make a statement against his own country. Yeah, I mean, I don't see how you could get much more anti-American than Tim McVeigh.
Well, I don't know how much you've read. What's his name? Who wrote the... His last autobiography ends it with a chapter on me. What's his name, Louise? Gore Vidal, yeah. I don't know if you've read his book on Tim McVeigh, where he interviewed him at some length. And Tim McVeigh thought of himself as a patriot. And no, I'm serious. He read the Turner Diaries was the problem. And you go back and you read the Turner Diaries and you get inside these movements. I've been on the right-wing shortwave radio stations shows. I've been a guest on their shows a number of times over the years. And people who are stocking up weapons and people like Gordon Liddy, who says, you know, if you see an ATF agent, shoot for the head because he's wearing body armor. And I would not even call Gordon Liddy anti-American. I would call him a terrorist. But I think that he's being a terrorist because he wants to make America a better place.
I'm not familiar with the remark you just attributed to Gordon Liddy. But
quite famous.
I suspect that he's joking. Now,
no, he wasn't joking.
Were that not a joke, obviously that's an outrageous statement on the face of it, but I don't care what Tim McVeigh thought he was. He was objectively anti-American. Objectively, the guy is anti-American. And I just don't see any way, I don't see a plausible argument for any other interpretation of what he was. The guy blew up a U.S. federal building.
No, well, here's my question. Are there, you know, Michelle Bachmann and others in your party are suggesting that Barack Obama is anti-American. Do you think that Barack Obama is anti-American?
Michelle Bachmann, as far as I know, is an excellent congresswoman. I don't know exactly what she said. Do I think that Barack Obama is anti-American? No. Do I think that Barack Obama's vision of America is in keeping with our traditional values and principles? No, they aren't. I think he would take the country in a radically different direction.
You mean back to where we were in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, and 60s and 70s?
No, I think there are basic principles about American freedom and American constitutionalism that Barack Obama is wrong on. I think a Barack Obama presidency, particularly with a Democratic majority Congress, would significantly change the country. Now, I think those things should be intelligently and honestly discussed. And this is a republic where people vote and they decide on where they want to go. Although I do think we have to stay within the confines of the Constitution, even when we're voting as a majority to do things. And yeah, I think he's going to take us in a very different direction.
Let me play. I heard this morning for the first time, and it somewhat concerns me. This is Sarah Palin in July of 2007. I'm sure you're familiar with the story of how Bill Kristol met her on a cruise 2 years ago, a cruise to Alaska.
I'm not familiar with the story.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, I suggest you Google it because it's all over. I mean, you know, this is again not a secret, and in fact, I think it was Frank Rich wrote about it in the New York Times, and was so impressed by her, he thought she's the next star. She's the one that we're going to make a star. And he had been the backroom advocate for her all along, and apparently he's the one who brought her to the McCain campaign. And after she got elected governor in late 2006 and became governor in early 2007 in Alaska, his PR machine was getting her on radio stations around the country and trying to raise her profile. And she was on KDKA in Pittsburgh, the America's first radio station. And this is an interview that the reporter there did with Sarah Palin. Just listen to this. He's asking her if she's going to run for president, if that's why she's being brought to him. You know, why is the governor of Alaska being brought to a radio station in Pittsburgh to be interviewed?
I guess the inevitable question now, considering where you are and how you got here, when will you be running for president?
President? president of the PTA, maybe?
Don't be coy, young lady. We both you know you're a hot property, so when will you be running for president?
Oh, shush. I'm going to tell my kids that and they'll laugh. Yeah.
You still haven't answered it, though.
I can't answer. I'll play political and not answer.
I'm sorry, what? Political what?
I said I'll play political and not answer.
Okay, wait a minute.
No. I don't want to sound like a politician.
Sure. Okay, then when will you be running for president?
I can't answer that, though. Life happens. Life happens. You don't know what happens in life.
Okay.
Hey, let me ask you, is it hot and sunny there in Pittsburgh?
No, it's been rainy and overcast. The weather here is a mess. But back to this, don't you? This is the first time you've tried to change the subject. I'm going to get a note of this. Subject.
First about the weather.
Time in conversation.
Oh, no.
About weather. Very clever. So, one last time. When would you be running for president?
I can't tell you, and I don't know what any future plans are going to be politically or professionally or anything else. No good answer there.
No good answer.
No. Sorry.
Okay, so she didn't answer no. All right, great.
So she didn't answer no. Isn't that a little terrifying?
No, not at all. In fact, what I hear there is what I've heard a lot from Sarah Palin, a very honest and unaffected person, which is quite unusual in America.
What I hear there is a 16-year-old.
That's ridiculous.
No, I'm quite serious. Any intelligent person who is thinking of running for president of the United States would rather than giggle and smirk around a question for a full minute and 20 seconds would say, you know, I just don't know. I might not, or what?
Tom, I'll tell you something that I think is truly different about her that I hear there and I've heard elsewhere is that unlike most people who rise to the top in American political life, who when they're about 6 years old start plotting and calculating to get into the White House and lie and scheme and create a completely false and phony persona in order to get...
Who are you talking about here? Richard Nixon?
I'm talking about the entire political class in Washington, D.C. Virtually every single person just about who's run for president, except I would exempt Ronald Reagan from that, who ran for president at a very advanced age and had not been plotting his entire life. Sarah Palin, I think, like Ronald Reagan, is someone who's a real person who wasn't plotting her entire life.
Wait a minute, there are unreal people?
Excuse me now?
There are unreal people?
Yes, I would say virtually everybody who runs for president is a phony on one level or another. And they are, in fact, alienated from the typical American middle-class person.
People who are not Americans or anti-Americans, and we have people who are not real people.
No, Tom, what I'm saying is that most politicians you talk to, and I've spent a lot of time interviewing politicians, do not want to give you a straight and honest answer to almost all questions you ask them. The job of journalists is to pin politicians
down. Well, how about when she was asked, you know, for example, 2 days ago, what's the job of the vice president? And you pick up this answer on the other side of the break here, Terry, because we're coming up on the break.
Sure.
I'll play the audio clip for you. What's the job of the vice president? And her answer was not just nonsensical, but either a misread of the Constitution or a complete rewrite of the Constitution. 16 minutes past the hour. We're talking Terry Jeffrey, the editor-in-chief at CNSNews.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
21 minutes past the hour, fair and slightly unbalanced. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Terry Jeffrey with us, the editor-in-chief at CNSNews.com. And, Terry, the two questions, I guess, well, I'll do them in order. The first one, of course, is Sarah Palin was asked by a third grader, but actually this is an answer that she gave to a reporter, not to a third grader. This is an adult talking to an adult about the role of the vice president.
All questions from the third grade.
Good.
Brandon Garcia wants to know, what does the vice president do?
That's something that Piper would ask me as a second grader also. That's a great question, Brandon. And a vice president has a really great job because not only are they there to support the president's agenda, they're like the team member, the teammate to that president, but also they're in charge of the United States Senate. So if they want to, they can really get in there with the senators and make a lot of good policy changes that will make life better for Brandon and his family and his classroom, and it's a great job, and I look forward to having that job.
Terry, are you as horrified as I am?
No.
This woman has never read the Constitution, or if she has, she doesn't understand what it means.
Well, Tom, right at this moment, I'm looking at Article 1 of the Constitution, Section 3, and it says, The Vice President of the United States shall be President of the Senate.
Right.
That shall have no vote unless they be equally divided.
Right.
And if you've read, there was in fact debate in the Constitutional Convention, in the state ratifying conventions about this. There's a lot of people who did not want that vote.
I have read them. It was understood at the time that president means the presiding officer. That's
right.
Why when people speak in the Senate, they say Mr. President, and they're speaking to the person who is sitting in on behalf of the, typically sitting in on behalf of the vice president.
That's right.
The vice president gavels the Senate into action at the beginning of every legislative session and gavels it closed at the end. And it's a pain in the butt job. John Adams complained bitterly about it when he was vice president of the George Washington administration. John Adams, who was one of the people who helped, he was the one of the three, him and Franklin and Jefferson, who he edited the Declaration of Independence. He was one of the people who helped write the Constitution, and it was very clear to him and to every vice president since then, with the possible exception of Dick Cheney, that it meant the presiding officer. It's a ceremonial duty. It is not a legislative duty.
But that's not true, because the actual wording of the Constitution, first of all, yes, the vice president has the constitutional authority to preside over the Senate, except for one circumstance, when they're impeaching the president. And I attended the impeachment trial of the president, by the way, in which case Chief Justice Rehnquist presided over the trial, not right. The vice president. But the Constitution not only gives them that power, but it also gives them the power to vote and break ties, which is a crucial power, which has been used by Dick Cheney, as you well know. So, yeah.
But that's a world of difference from getting in there with all the senators and helping them craft legislation.
Well, John Adams did it, and there's nothing. Look, the senators can deal with the vice president however they wish, except they do have to recognize the express authority given to him by the Constitution.
You know, when LBJ was vice president, he went down to the Senate caucus, they have this luncheon once a week, Democratic caucus in the Senate, dining room.
Mm-hmm.
And his first week as vice president, after he had been sworn in, he went down and tried to join them, and they threw him out.
Well, he doesn't have to have lunch with them. That's what they do. In fact, by the way, the vice president does maintain an office in the Senate office buildings. And he can preside over the Senate whenever he wants, which means he can control the flow of debate in the Senate if he actually wanted to. And he does have a vote and ties, and those ties have been very, very important on very important pieces of legislation.
So you're saying that we need to reinvent the office of vice president. If Joe Biden is elected, you want him to be very actively involved in the legislative process?
It is up to him. And of course, there's the politics of that. But if he look, good vice presidents are. And Dan Quayle, for example, like LBJ, had been a member of the Senate. He did a lot of politicking in the United States Senate for the senior President Bush. Al Gore had been a member of the Senate. He was a political asset to President Clinton.
But he didn't. I think we've exhausted this. We just have a minute left, Terry. I just have a real quick question for you.
Not constitutional prerogative. They do have the constitutional power to do this.
Okay. All right. Question, and this is kind of in the context of My Fair Lady here. I'm curious how your party is going to respond to the $150,000 at Neiman Marcus and Saks Fifth Avenue that the Republican National Committee has paid for clothing for Sarah Palin.
Rewrite the campaign laws. I mean, the fact is that these campaigns can spend this money.
See, I have no problem with this. I think it's entirely appropriate that she be well-dressed. And I have no problem with the party paying for it. But I would think that from a Republican point of view, I think it's going to hurt her with your base. Why didn't Cindy McCain, who's worth $100 million, say, here, Sarah, here's my credit card?
No, this is money that contributors sent in, and it's publicly reported. And that's the way they leave it. If people can debate what they think about the way they spent the money, we know.
So you don't think it's going to hurt her with
no,
Republican base?
No, I don't think it's going to hurt her with Republicans.
Okay. Oh, interesting. Okay, Terry Jeffries, CNSNews.com, the website. Terry, thanks for dropping by.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270, our telephone number, TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
It's so easy to catch people doing things wrong. We all do it all the time, but it's actually much more effective to catch people doing things right. And I just want to tip my hat to Janine Bonparth from Code Pink, who tried to do a citizen's arrest for treason on Karl Rove last night. Good on you, Janine. Congratulations. Karl Rove was speaking Tuesday at the Mortgage Broker Association's annual convention. I guess those mortgage bankers just love the Bush administration. After all, George, in his State of the Union address in 2002, talked about how we need to make people with bad credit able to buy homes, you know. So anyhow, she tried to do a citizen's arrest, and he, shrugged her off as she tried to put handcuffs on him, and she got let off the stage. So good try, Janine. Tip of the hat to you, and keep up the great work. 866-303-2270, our phone number, Tupac in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Tupac.
Hey, good morning, Tom. I just want to touch on that, if it's allowed, for an indigenous voice on the theme of loving America.
Mm-hmm.
I think, I just came back from Colombia. I spent 2 weeks in Colombia. I got back this weekend. And, I really appreciate the statements from the labor leaders on the Colombia-U.S. trade pact. But at present, we got about 3,000 indigenous peoples blocking the Pan-American Highway in Colombia and suffering deaths and military attacks by the Colombian Army under President Uribe. But to get back to the loving America, I really think that the time is now. This is the era. This is the epoch. And with the presidency of Obama at the threshold, we need to expand that love for America to understand that we're all Americans in this continent, in the sense that we're all part of the same country.
Yeah.
And we as indigenous
especially the indigenous Americans.
We really love this land, and we love the people of the land, and we really would like to see our brothers and sisters, wherever they may be from Europe or Asia or any of the other continents, to share that love with us. But we need to respect each other at the same time.
Yeah, very
and
well
that means we need to have an appreciation for the rights of the indigenous nations at a continental level in terms of not a Monroe Doctrine, but a doctrine of mutual respect and self-determination.
Excellent. Well said, Tupac. Thank you very much for the call. Jeff in the Bahamas. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
Just great, but I'll get better. How about you?
I'm pretty good. I've been trying to get a hold of your show for the longest time, calling out of the Bahamas.
Well, thank you for finally getting through.
Yes, thank you. I'm just basically calling to congratulate you. I don't know very much about you, but I've been following the primaries and the caucuses since late January. And the information that I've been getting from your talk show has been helpful in my following the U.S. political landscape, and just listening to the information that you're giving, the unbiased reports of what the facts are. I really appreciate the effort that you're doing.
Jeff, I'm not unbiased. I'm pretty clear about my bias. I put it right out there. But thank you for your kind words. Did you have a comment beyond that or a question?
Yes, actually, in regards to the tone of the Republican campaign.
Yes.
As far as what they're trying to do in reference to just lambasting the Democratic campaign, I've been appalled at what I've been hearing from Senator John McCain and his representatives, and even all the way from the Bahamas and following up with it. I think it takes a special or a different caliber of individual who has to be wired a bit differently than the rest of us to be able to look at truth, to be able to look at information, and to call right wrong and wrong right.
Yeah. Jeff, I'm curious if in Bahamian politics, the phrase anti-Bahamian, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, is used. Do you have people who actually question each other's patriotism or loyalty to their country?
Absolutely not. You know, here in the Bahamas, we love our country. We love the Commonwealth of the Bahamas. And when it comes to issue and political issues, we judge each other by what's right and what's wrong. And we don't try to presume that we know people's motives, but we deal based on what people say and their actual track record.
Right.
You either are or you either aren't. But to try to paint someone a certain way or to put mistruths or misinformation to try to discredit somebody's reputation to receive a required goal or aim. I mean, it's just unbelievable, the tone of the...
And it's wrong. Very well said.
Yeah, absolutely wrong.
Jeff, thank you so much for the call. Thanks for listening to us.
You're welcome, and keep up the great work, Tom.
Thank you. I will do my very best. Thank you, Jeff. Tom in Sioux City, Iowa. Hey, Tom.
Hey, Tom. How are you doing today?
Just great. What's up?
Well, I just wanted to throw in a third aspect of I think a previous caller had mentioned as well about either being pro-America or anti-America, and that is... the third aspect is just don't care about America and try to gobble up what you can for yourself, like we see with, you know, the current administration and the powers that are controlling this country. And just one last comment before I get off the line here, and that is for all that George Bush has done to this country, there is one good thing I can say that he has done, and that is that he has thrust Barack Obama as a front runner in Democratic politics, and I am proud to say that I cast my vote for him earlier this week.
Oh, good on you, Tom.
So,
and, you know,
I'll just get off the line here and let someone else get in.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Thanks for the call. You know, Tom was just talking about antipathy, I guess, or whatever, this I don't care attitude. Robert McKee teaches a brilliant screenwriting course, which I have taken three times. I found it very useful in writing the novels that I've written. And in it, he talks about how the opposite of love is not hate. It is not caring. And in a way, that's the opposite of hate as well. I thought that was a powerful point and one that frankly needs to be made more often. Michelle in Pennsylvania. Hey, Michelle.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi. Well, I wanted to first of all thank all the callers who've been calling in from Canada, and we just had the gentleman from the Bahamas. It's been very interesting to hear their perspectives. But what I wanted to do is comment on, you know, the anti-American or un-American. I've been told by Republicans some really nasty things about myself because I oppose the war.
Yeah, you should read my email.
Oh, boy. Well, you know, I felt like on 9/11 when when the terrorists came to our country and they killed 3,000 of our people, they killed 3,000 of our people without cause. And I felt like, you know, I love our country and I love especially our people. Our country's just not our laws. It's the people who make that up. And when we put our sons and daughters in harm's way and we know that their lives are going to be lost, we have to be the utmost responsible. And we can't, in the same token, go to other countries and take the lives of their innocent people and call it protecting our interests. And if you want to call me anti-American, please do, because I think as a country we can do better. And I think that if we are a great country, we have a moral obligation to really look at what we're doing.
Yeah, but see, I would say that's pro-American. I'd say if you want to call me anti-American, please don't, because I'm not anti-American. I love this country, and I don't think we should have invaded Afghanistan. I think we should have taken the Taliban's offer that they would give us Osama bin Laden, or they'd give him to a third country where he could get a fair trial, and it would have been the end of it. It would have been a Tim McVeigh kind of resolution, frankly. You know, throw the bum in jail, and I think it would have been the thing that would have harmed al-Qaeda more than anything else. And instead, George Bush did exactly what Osama bin Laden wanted. Pardon my friend interrupting you, Michelle, but...
No, that's okay. When other countries look at us, even right now, I think, is this... When, you know, I'm a young, relatively young person, and this is the only campaign where I can think the attacks got so nasty. You know, and we don't have this in other dignified democratic countries like Canada and Europe and all over the world. People don't act like this, and I think we have to stop... You know, unfortunately, I heard your guest, and you know, anything that the Republican Party does is right. And until they really look at that mentality that we're right about morals, we're right about this, we're right about that, there's never going to be any compromise. And I think that it's just very, you know, it's very frustrating. But I really the thing that bothers me is how they all believe that they're right and they're very justified in these attacks.
Yeah, no, you're right, Michelle. And was it George Santayana or was it Disraeli? I forget who said, you know, maybe even Samuel Johnson. Patriotism is the last refuge of the scoundrel. We're seeing a lot of scoundrels here. Suzanne in Scottsdale. We got about a minute before the break. Suzanne, what's up?
Tom, many years ago when I was in school, I had to write a paper, and I chose a paper on whether sororities and fraternities were democratic. And after a lot of research, I came to the conclusion that they were, because everyone has the right to choose their friends and who they associate with. But at the end of it, I came across a quotation by Edwin Markham, and I think it's the most profound quotation I've ever come across. And this is what it was. They drew a circle that shut me out. Heretic, rebel, a thing to flout. But love, I had the wit to win. I drew a circle that took them in.
That's brilliant. Suzanne, thank you so much for sharing that with us. That's great. A perfect note to end the segment on. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our radio program, by the way, brought to you in part by the Teamsters, proud supporters of the Employee Free Choice Act. Check it out at teamster.org. We'll be right back. 866-303-2270. TomHartman.com for our free chat room. Watch out.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
$50,000 each to contractors to go over there. Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. The Tom Hartman Program. You know, the less you pay attention, the worse politics you'll get. So pay attention. And strange stuff, by the way, going on in the world. Full Monty alert for the day.
Better take off your coat.
Uh-oh. Real slow, yeah.
Real slow.
Firefighters in Britain had a couple of interesting encounters on Wednesday.
Baby, take off your shoes. Yeah, I'll take your shoes.
One was a runaway hamster. They spent 5 futile hours looking for Fudgy in the floorboards of his home. They were using a vacuum cleaner, a sock, and a tiny camera dipped in chocolate. And the other was, yeah, leaving her hat on, a naked burglar. Burglar had to be freed from the chimney at a supermarket near Manchester, Northern England. 22-year-old suspect lost his clothes trying to squeeze his way out. Was treated in the hospital. Strange goings on in the UK. Speaking of strange goings on in the UK, you got out of there just in time, didn't you, Victoria Jones?
Those Brits, I'm telling you.
It's something in the water.
Yeah.
So, Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, the website. And what's going on in the world today, Victoria?
Well, as you know, the president announced today that the Global Economic Summit will take place on November the 15th, and the president-elect will play a role in that. So exactly what role the president-elect will play and what role the president will play is unclear, but there will be some juggling going on.
Interesting. Hey, I have a question for you. You're the perfect person to ask it. Answer it. As most Americans don't know who Guy Fawkes was or what Guy Fawkes Day is.
Yes.
And everybody in the UK does.
Right. Yes.
I mean, you guys have fireworks on
November. We do. We have fireworks and baked potatoes and sausages.
Yes, to celebrate Guy Fawkes. And I don't think most Americans realize that November 5th, the day after our election, is Guy Fawkes Day.
Yes, it is. Remember the 5th of November, gunpowder, treason, and plot.
That's right. Indeed. You've got it right. And there's another two lines to the poem, which I've forgotten.
I've forgotten, too.
Yeah. So last night, Louise and I watched V for Vendetta. It's showing on FX channel. It's showing again tonight. You can track it down and watch it. And I watched it when it first came out back in 2005. And it occurred to me that maybe we ought to. Now, you know, I'm not advocating gunpowder or blowing up Parliament or anything like that.
No.
But as Guy Fawkes tried to do. But it was a day of rebellion, you know, of standing up and speaking out. And maybe November 5th, whether it is a day when we all go out in the streets with a candle to celebrate and we turn on every light and honk every horn in America, or whether it's a day when we all go out and stand in the streets and say, I'm going to sit here on this in this crosswalk and we're going to shut down the country because we think the election's been stolen. I'm not sure which way it's going to go, but maybe we should be talking about Guy Fawkes.
It might not be a bad idea. I mean, that's pretty radical.
It is.
But you
radical,
are a radical.
I'll be the first to confess. So anyhow, V for Vendetta, FX channel, I think it is, whatever that means. That's what I saw in the little corner of the screen last night, and it's playing again tonight, at least on our cable system here. And so if you haven't seen V for Vendetta, check it out, and which is not really entirely about Guy Fawkes, but mostly. I mean, it's a great story. There's a lot of twists and turns in it and secondary stuff. So what else is going on in the world, Victoria Jones?
Well, of course, Sarah Palin's clothes.
Yes, $150,000 paid for by the RNC.
More even than I could spend. I mean, and
really?
I try.
Yeah. It's a lot of money, really, when you think about it.
It's a lot of money. You know, it's a bleep load of money.
After taxes, you'd have to earn $250,000 to have that kind of money to spend on.
That is a lot of money. I mean, now, $4,700 on hair and makeup. Now, that is understandable because makeup, getting a makeup person, that costs money. Spending that on hair, it's very difficult to spend that much on hair. But on clothes, going to Saks and Neiman Marcus, she is buying designer stuff. She is, like that red leather jacket she was wearing yesterday, that cost between $5,000 and $10,000.
Yeah.
That was the jacket she wore when she was talking about the vice president's role in the Senate.
And all her conversations about Joe Sixpack. So our official Sarah Palin music for the day. Here we go.
How kind of you to let me come.
Now once again, where does it rain?
On the plane.
Yes.
There we go. So, my fair lady.
Perfect.
I thought so.
It's perfect. Well,
what amazes me is that the Republicans can get in such a snit about John Edwards paying $400 for a haircut, when actually you could argue that pretty much was the only option he had at that. Well, you can't argue that, I guess. Anyhow, he had a $400 haircut. Sarah Palin has $150,000. Cindy McCain showed up at a rally with $350,000 worth of clothes and jewels on her body all at one time.
Yeah.
And Joe the plumber is like, well, that's fine.
Yeah, it's fine, because that's what some people want to aspire to be able to do. And so it's fine. But they think that if Democrats do it, Democrats shouldn't be able to do it, because Democrats should be being poor and socialist.
Mm. Well, you see, this is the fundamental recalibration of the American dream. The American dream, historically, right up until 1980, I mean, almost 200 years at the point of 1980, the American dream always meant being able to have basically a middle-class life, being able to raise your family, put your kids through school, own your home, have a decent retirement, you know, have something to pass along. And Reagan recalibrated that to the American dream, meaning that you're going to be that small 1% who have essentially hit the jackpot, who for whatever reason, very often hard work, I'll acknowledge that, have become millionaires and billionaires. And that's not the American dream.
No, and it's not possible.
For the vast majority of Americans, it is absolutely not possible, because it is a zero-sum game. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
You know, sometimes you know what you know, and sometimes you know what you don't know, and sometimes you don't know even, sometimes even everything you know is wrong, as the Paris and Theater points out.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
The author of Farmer's New York City Guide with Kids, 500 Places to Take Your Kids Before They Grow Up, the forthcoming 500 Places for Food and Wine Lovers, the editor of the annual Best Food Writing Anthologies for Farmers, farmers.com. Holly Hughes is with us about a new book, 500 Places to See Before They Disappear. Hey, Holly.
Hey, how are you, Tom?
Just great. Glad to have you with us. You've got some of my favorite cities in here. Dubrovnik. We did our show from Dubrovnik last year.
Mm-hmm.
Venice. Louise and I have been there a number of times. They're vanishing?
Well, Venice is sinking into the lagoon.
It's true.
It was built a long time ago on wooden pilings, and they're rotting.
Yeah, yeah. And as the water rises, well, it's amazing, wandering around in Venice and taking a gondola, and you're looking at water in the middle of a window that used to be the first floor of a house, or
yeah,
in some cases even the second floor of a house.
Right. And in the case of Dubrovnik, there was a lot of, Eastern Europe, a lot of deforestation over the years, and suddenly the courses, there was nothing to prevent the rivers from sudden flooding, and there's that terrible flooding all over Europe, but especially bad in the former East Germany and parts of Poland over the, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, just really wreaked havoc in a lot of those older cities.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And we're seeing the same thing in many places in the United States
yeah.
as well. I guess this is just all over the world as you pave over land. And there's a butterfly preserve. Now, I live on the Willamette River opposite a butterfly preserve, and we've got a bunch of endangered species that come through there, and in fact I think it's the state is administering it. And then there's a large volunteer group who every spring go out and pull out the invasive species and plant native species that are needed for these migrating butterflies. But apparently this is the mother lode of all butterfly preserves in West Eugene, Oregon, the Willow Creek Preserve.
Oh yes, just amazing stuff. And you know, it's really this web of life. You know, there are certain flowers that certain butterflies, you know, it sort of goes against what you'd think with the survival of the fittest. But
yeah,
they have been bred to only land on certain flowers during their brief lifetime.
Yeah.
When those flowers go, they have no, you know, the butterflies just don't know how to cope.
It's it's really tragic, actually. One of my very favorite stories growing up was The Snows of Kilimanjaro by
mm-hmm.
Ernest Hemingway, which is just this incredibly poignant story of literally of life and death and relationships. But it takes place at the foot of Kilimanjaro And at the very end of that story, there's the story about, or maybe it opens. No, it ends with the leopard being frozen in the snow up at the top of Kilimanjaro. The snows are vanishing.
That snow cap is vanishing. It's a little bit different from what's happening to making glaciers melt. The odd thing was always that there was snow there because it's very close to the equator. You would hardly expect something to be snow capped year round.
Yeah.
Climate changes. In that case, it's a little bit more sort of natural cyclical things. And I think one of the problems is that we live such a short span on the Earth that we're not in touch with the great long geological curves of climate change.
Holly Hughes, we're talking with Holly Hughes, the new book, A Celebration of the World's Most Fragile Wonders, 500 Places to See Before They Disappear. Holly, what would be if you were to recommend two or three places to somebody who had the means or ability to do some traveling on a vacation or retirement or whatever? What would be at the top of the list in your mind?
One of the things about this book is that it kind of has gone in two directions. One of them is very much natural wonders, and the other one is historic things. And many times they kind of come together into the same thing. I mean, in the Far East, there's some amazing things like Borobudur in Indonesia, which was this, you know, monument designed for meditation, where the monks would walk in contemplative circles around this, you know, the spirals of this monument. And, it was never designed to have as many tourists walking on it as it now has.
Right.
Was not preserved for many generations, was swallowed up by the jungle, and that wreaked havoc on the stones. And now that it's wonderfully been, sort of cut out of the jungle, people are going to visit it, and it's rapidly decaying. Now, it wasn't built to last as long as it has, but it would be a shame to let it degenerate anymore, and certainly people need to get over there and see wonderful things like that.
Yeah, there's all through that area, Indonesia, Malaysia. Louise and I, many years ago, took a small sailing ship through the Straits of Malacca with Pol Pot's doctor, who was the Red Cross doctor who had been working in Cambodia for years and years. And there's just some amazing ruins and temples, and it's just an extraordinary part of the world. Holly, thanks so much for being with us and for writing this, Frommer's 500 Places to See Before They Disappear. You've done a great job. Is there a website for this, or is just people should just get the book?
There's Frommer's.com.
Frommer's.com.
Yeah, a lot of information about all of these sites.
Great. And F-R-O-M-M-E-R-S. Holly, thanks a lot for dropping by.
Yeah. Thanks so much.
Great talking with you. 12 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman radio program. And Robert in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Robert, what's on your mind today?
Tom, thanks for taking my call. I've got a comment, and then I've got a question for you. And this involves I'm betting on Barack Obama if his people get out and vote. I think he is going to be the next president. Secretary of State, very important. I think the Bush-Cheney administration has essentially ruined our reputation among our allies in Russia and China on the world front. Now, celebrities in politics is nothing new. Ronald Reagan, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Jesse Ventura, Sonny Bono, on and on and on. My comment first and then my question. My comment is, I know some people that work for Barack Obama's campaign in Ohio and in Arizona. There are rumors about a certain celebrity, I think you know who I'm going to drop, Shakira being offered a cabinet post under Barack Obama's administration. As you know, she recently spoke in front of Congress and then was interviewed by Wolf Blitzer. I think because of her being friends with virtually every major world leader, her education, her charismatic personality, I think this is the type of person we need to be Secretary of State. But my question to you, who do you think would be a good Secretary of State?
That's a good question, Robert. I honestly don't know. I frankly haven't sat down with a list of cabinet appointments and thought, you know, who should be this person. Robert Reich did a great job as Secretary of Labor under Clinton, and they really didn't let him do what he should have done. And in fact, I think he'd make a great Secretary of the Treasury. But beyond that, I just don't know. Tom in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Tom.
Hi, Tom. I'd like to pick up an earlier thread, the FDR comment
about economic royalists. What a wonderful phrase that was.
Yes.
And do you think that it's built into the American Constitution, this economic royalism, that, you know, this country is basically about getting rich, and once you're rich, you have to be deferred to and you're legitimized just because you have wealth?
No, in fact, if anything, it's the exact opposite. I mean, quite literally the exact opposite. It's not what the founders had in mind. Jefferson warned about excessive wealth. None of the founders were truly wealthy people. They were all what today would be called the upper middle class. None of them left fortunes. None of them left wealthy families. None of them left foundations. In fact, the first person to have, in today's dollars, $1 million, which is not a lot of money, was in 1791. Even John Hancock, who was the wealthiest of all the signers of the Declaration of Independence, was not a millionaire. They were absolutely opposed to that kind of an accumulation of wealth. Here's another clip from Franklin Roosevelt talking, you know, about this kind of an issue.
Private enterprise, indeed, became too private. It became privileged enterprise, not free enterprise.
There you go, talking about the rise of the economic royalists. And the economic royalists, you know, have risen up in the United States and have taken over much of the United States, and it's a problem, frankly. And that's not class warfare to say that. It is simply a statement of fact. You know, you want class warfare, look at the fact that you got 40 million Americans who have no health insurance, that even people with health insurance can be wiped out. Half of all bankruptcies are caused by medical expenses, and half of those people were insured. In fact, a little more than half of them, majority of them were insured. I mean, you want class warfare, you've got the top 1% of Americans control 90% of the wealth and 50% of the income. I would say that is the class that has declared warfare on the rest of Americans, if you want to call it that. 16 minutes past.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
See my interview with Russian television. It's over at RussiaToday.com. It was on the front page last week because it was an interview from the week before last. They actually flew out here to Portland to do it. It's buried somewhere in the website now. I didn't take the time actually during the break to dig through, but it's RussiaToday.com. Some people were asking where can we see that. And speaking of Russia, actually this is more appropriate music, I think. Russia, this is from the RIAN.ru. This is an actual Russian website based out of Russia, from the Moscow Military District. Is that no, it's Russian News and Information Agency, Novosti. And here's the story. Russian UN mission gets letter from McCain seeking election cash. Yes, the Russians are actually writing about this in their newspaper. Here's the story. Dateline, Novosti, RIA Novosti, October 20th. Russia's permanent mission to the UN has received a letter from U.S. Republican presidential candidate John McCain asking for financial support of his election campaign, the mission said in a statement on Monday. Quote, we have received a letter from Senator John McCain with a request for a financial donation to his presidential election campaign. In this respect, we have to reiterate that neither Russia's permanent mission to the UN, nor the Russian government, nor its official finance officials finance political activities in foreign countries. The letter dated the 29th and signed by McCain was addressed to Vitaly Churkin, the Russian envoy to the UN, and was dated October 16. The ambassador's title was not included in the letter and was not clear why the letter had taken over 2 weeks to arrive. Enclosed was a request for a donation of up to $5,000 to McCain's election campaign to be returned with check or permission to withdraw the money from the donor's credit card until October 24. individual donations to election campaigns are capped by law at $2,300, and it is illegal to accept donations from foreign nationals. And then they go on through this whole thing, and they just say, legal barriers aside, the request and the official response from the Russian mission appear even more confusing in the light of McCain's overall negative attitude toward Russia. And then they quote some, you know, Russia bashing by John McCain. And, you know, isn't this interesting? I mean, you know, obviously what they got was just a standard fundraising letter. So, you know, I mean, but they thought it was, I mean, they're taking it like, oh, isn't this inappropriate to be asking the Russia's permanent mission to the UN for a contribution? Yes, it is inappropriate. Kelly in Los Angeles. Hey, Kelly, what's on your mind today?
Hello. Yeah, basically the idea of anti-American is code that relates to the ongoing battle for reality between the American corporations and the American people.
Well, that's a good one. I'd say it's code for the two different views of America. One view of America is an authoritarian, hierarchical, patriarchal, top-down, you know, very little democracy and a lot of control at the top view, which is typically referred to as conservative. And the other is a bottom-up, egalitarian. Everybody participates. Everybody has some skin in the game. Everybody is, you know, as many people participating as possible, a bottom-up approach, which is generally referred to as liberal, and which, by the way, was the vision of the founders of this country. So, but, yeah, it is code. You're absolutely right. Patrick in North Hollywood, or in Hollywood, rather.
Hi. Well, my question is exactly on what you're discussing right now. The commercial media in this country, with all of its bias, which is not left-wing, in my opinion, constantly talks about socialism more recently. They throw it around haphazardly to describe the trickle-down bailout for the, you know, the big banks,
mm-hmm.
as well as for people like Barack's policies. And I'd like to ask you and your listeners to think why this media in this country is so easy to label the policies of the left wing as socialism and are so loath to label the policies of the right wing or the conservatives as fascism.
Yeah. And the reason why is because both words have been distorted, Patrick. Socialism has been conflated with communism, which is not, and fascism has been conflated with dictatorship, which it's not. Fascism is the merging of corporate and state interests, and socialism is basically providing a strong social safety net for people, and the government providing those services that have to do with the commons, you know, in fully. Including the commons of health care, but communism is the government controlling the means of supply and distribution, and, you know, manufacture and supply. And I
may make a comment.
Yeah, go for it.
You mentioned that fascism has to do with dictatorship, as let's say a person like Mussolini or what's his name. But what I would like to put forth is that the dictatorship exists. Not from a person like an emperor with clothes, but from an ideology, from a bunch of corporate fascists, and that is still well applicable to the system in which we live.
Yeah, no, Patrick, it is an ideological battle. It absolutely is. It's a battle of worldviews, and it goes all the way back to Sir Edmund Burke having a debate with Thomas Paine. Which so infuriated Paine that he wrote a book which everybody should read called The Rights of Man. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
We'll be right back.
back to mainstream media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. And John Dean is on the line with us, former White House counsel in the Nixon era, attorney, author, a columnist for FindLaw.com. FindLaw.com/Dean or writ.news-findlaw.com/Dean. And John Dean, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom.
Your book, which we interviewed you about when it first came out in hardcover, Broken Government, How Republican Rule Destroyed the Legislative, Executive, and Judicial Branches, is now out in paperback. Is that?
It is out in paperback just before the election.
Great. And let me add that your books, Conservative Without Conscience and Worse Than Watergate, I know you've written several others, one about Rehnquist, which I haven't read, but those two books I have read, and they are absolute must reading, all three of them. This is a brilliant trilogy. And, you know, get to your local bookstore or get over to Amazon or whatever, you know, your favorite, Powell's.com, whatever, plug in John Dean and check these books out. John Dean, I noticed on your website, you know, the one over at findlaw.com, your blog, basically, and the most recent entry is your reflections on this conversation that you had with Mary Hershberger about McCain's war record.
Yeah.
And it was rather shocking, frankly, the things that she was talking about that John Dean, taking down his image as a war hero. That topic is absolutely sacrosanct. It's something that, or untouchable. It's something that the Democrats don't go near. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Well, what was struck me is how Mary had tried to place the story, her research. She's a historian. She's an expert on North Vietnam. She's studied, you know, both before the war and after the war. She'd done a biography on Jane Fonda, is where I happened to meet her when I was having a lunch with Jane, and Mary was there also because she was working on this biography. And then she started reading McCain's material, and she sent me her draft column along the way, and said, you know, I've really run out of sources, of places to do this, but I've got it out at a couple online sources, and one of them, Truthdig, did take the piece. They verified everything she'd said, and they ran with it. But all the mainstream, even websites, if you will, turned her down. And this is solid research, and it's pretty devastating material, drawing in question McCain's own account of his, not his POW. She's focused on that, but this was his career as a pilot and his experience on the Forrestal, which has been totally misrepresented.
Right, this disaster where over 100 sailors died, and he apparently was right at the epicenter of it.
And left the ship.
Yeah, for some R&R, and lied about one of the guys that died 3 days later, saying he watched the guy die. Actually, he was off in Saigon, sitting in a bar drinking or whatever he was prone to do in those days. It's
pretty striking that this has become an area that, for some reason, the mainstream just won't touch, and not even, and when I say mainstream, there's a number of websites that are also becoming increasingly mainstream. They won't touch it. But those that are a little more aggressive are filling that void, and one should not wonder what's happening to the mainstream press anymore, why people don't tune it in or read it, is because they don't really give people what they want, or are digging in and finding out the answers to questions like, you know, what is McCain's real history?
Yeah, and this is an excellent interview, and you can find it in John Dean's column over at findlaw.com, his interview with Mary Hershberger. And I think, frankly, they're afraid of being called Swift boaters, but this is a whole completely different thing than Swift boating, because this is just basically a historian laying out the facts. You have another piece, Vice President Dick Cheney's Incredible and Deadly Lie. By deceiving a congressional leader, Cheney sent us to war on false premises and violated the separation of powers, as well as the criminal law. Now, this is a whole different take on Cheney and the selling of the war than is conventional wisdom.
That's correct. Cheney fascinates me. I think he, in a sense, is a genius in that he lets George Bush wake up every morning and actually believe he is president. And Bush is no small ego. But yet Cheney knows how to do it by controlling the information that gets to the president. And then Cheney has just been literally a bold-faced liar about countless major issues. and I address one of them in this piece, of course, because it's so striking. He just doesn't seem to care. I think he's also was quite stunned when a federal court recently ruled that he had to actually preserve his papers because he's been busy up there on at the Naval Observatory where he lives and has his office destroying papers. But the court has now said, no, Mr. Cheney, you are subject to the 1978 Presidential Records Act. So if he now starts destroying his documents, what's left of them, he'll be in contempt of court.
Yeah, which may or may not be a cause of concern for him. It seems like these guys they ignore subpoenas.
They do ignore subpoenas.
If you or I did that, we'd be in jail, would we not?
Well, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. You know, it'll be very curious. Obviously, if McCain wins on November 4th, the Bush-Cheney people are going to get a pass. Obama has said a couple times along the way that if he finds indeed egregious behavior by his predecessor, that he's going to ask his attorney general to look at it and to see if this stuff should be prosecuted. And these people are still will be under the statute of limitations for a number of, I think, blatant crimes they've committed. And whether Obama would do that or not, I don't know. It's a tough call for a president, somebody particularly who will be trying to bring the country together to, if you will, in a Nixonian term, to pick that old scab.
But in a way, isn't that bringing the country together? I mean, the Nuremberg trials actually healed Germany and much of Europe, because they gave closure to it. The Tim McVeigh trial gave closure to the people who were the victims of his bombing in Oklahoma City. I think that Jerry Ford really, really set a terrible precedent. And then the Clinton administration, when they came in, by not pursuing Iran-Contra and some of the crimes of the Reagan and Bush years, set another terrible precedent of saying, basically, you know, we're going to give previous presidents a pass, presumably in the expectation that future presidents would give them a pass. And pretty much the Bush administration stopped all the investigations into the Clinton administration. And so I guess this has just kind of become the old boys club now.
It has become the norm, Tom, no question. And that's why it was sort of striking that Obama made this statement when pressed by a reporter on these issues.
Yeah.
And that was out of the norm. So the very fact he made it may mean that he is going to be good for his word. But he has also slipped on his word on a couple issues to sort of go to the middle and to be less controversial on things like the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act amendments.
Of course, that's in the midst of a campaign. As Franklin Roosevelt proved, all bets are off, or for that matter, as George W. Bush proved, all bets are off once you're president. We're talking with John Dean, the attorney and author, former White House counsel in the Nixon era. His book, Broken Government, How Republican Rule Destroyed the Legislative, Executive, and Judicial Branches, now out in paperback. And his previous books, Worse Than Watergate and Conservatives Without a Conscience. These are three books you must have on your shelf. Just extraordinary, extraordinary books. You're blogging or writing, John Dean, over at findlaw.com about the Sarah Palin selection. We've played a little audio here today of Sarah Palin being interviewed back in 2007 that it was absolutely startling, almost frightening in its juvenile nature. You're suggesting that she actually is not qualified by the definitions of the Constitution to be vice president.
That's right. If you look at the standard, and there is no obviously criteria set out in the Constitution. In fact, all the constitutional reflection on the vice presidency was really an afterthought by our founders. It did get picked up in the 20th Amendment, but it's really not been something that's been any focus. But there is a provision that if there's a vacancy in that office, then the president can fill the vacancy with the advice and consent of both the House and the Senate. In other words, their approval. And if you look at it's been used twice. It's been used when Nixon filled the Agnew vacancy with Gerald Ford, and then Gerald Ford filled the vacancy when he was elevated to become president with Nelson Rockefeller.
Right.
Now, there is an implicit criteria that those presidents that were followed in those two instances that was somebody who was confirmable by the House and Senate. Now, there's just not a Chinaman that's not a bad, that's a bad phrase. There's not a hope that that Sarah Palin could ever get confirmed by the House and Senate. They would not find her qualified. And that was, you know, she's not in the league of a Rockefeller. She's not in the league of a Gerald Ford. McCain, if he were president, would never even begin to nominate someone like Sarah Palin to do that, knowing very well he'd never get her confirmed. And it would be an embarrassment. Yet he's using it for, you know, the short-term political gain that he's getting out of it during the race. So that's the basis. And, you know, and she's just been strikingly unprepared even to run as a candidate, most recently showing her ignorance about still what the vice president's role is, right, where she's saying the vice president's in charge of the Senate.
Yeah,
so that's rather pathetic.
Yeah, I had a conservative on the program today, Terry Jeffries from CNS News, the editor-in-chief there, saying, in fact, that she's right. I mean, it's scary. They're all adopting these. John W. Dean, author, attorney, former White House counsel, his books, his newest book out in paperback, it is, where'd it go? Broken Government, How Republican Rule Destroyed the Legislative, Executive, and Judicial Branches. Thank you, sir, for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
Associated Press looking into, welcome back by the way, looking into Sarah Palin's charging the state for her children to travel with her. This is as governor of Alaska, including to events where they were not invited, and later amending expense reports to specify that they were on official business. Nice work if you can get it. $21,000 worth of travel for her three daughters, 64 one-way, 12 round-trip commercial flights since she took office in December of 2006. Charged the state for hotel rooms for her girls. Yeah. The $150,000 for clothes. I think the Republicans have a big problem here. I think they have a real sad situation. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. David in Cincinnati, you wanted to disagree with me about unions? David? No, David. Okay. Jeremy in Huntington Beach, California. Hey, Jeremy, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Talk about anti-Americanism. The Heritage Foundation, this guy Paul Weyrich in 87, talked about how the American system promotes amateurism and how they need, what they really want is a quote-unquote shadow government, basically making decisions behind, you know, closed doors.
This is not new, Jeremy. This, if you go back and read the notes of the Constitutional Convention, this was the perspective of the conservatives at the founding of this country, was that we wanted to have the appearance, they wanted there to be the appearance of democracy, but actually have the government tightly controlled by a small group of people. And to a certain extent, they won in the compromise in which the United States Senate was not to be elected by the people, but instead was appointed by the states. And that stood until, as I recall, 1918, 1917, something like that, just a little before 1920, the United States Senate was not elected by you and me. Our senators weren't elected. They were appointed by the states. So there's a long history in America of conservatives not trusting what John Adams referred to as the rabble.
Yeah, well, if you look at, like, their president and vice president decisions, it's no mystery. Look at Reagan, who's completely clueless. I have no doubt that he actually didn't know what was happening in Nicaragua and South America. Then you look at Dan Quayle, at Sarah Palin. You know, I mean, they want clueless people because they're going to have no clue what's going on behind closed doors.
Right. It's their, you would refer to them, I think, or they would refer to them as useful idiots and spot on. And then, you know, the question is, who's really pulling the strings? Is it Cheney or is it, you know, Rumsfeld or is it some corporation that has bought them or what and where? I, you know, anyway, Prez in Santa Rosa, California. Hey, Prez.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. I wanted to comment that last caller brought up a point. Just look at the reaction of the before the Constitutional Convention, what they did in response to Shays' Rebellion. That'll show you a lot right there, you know, to take care of the so-called rabble.
Yeah, well, they put down the rabble pretty quickly in Shays.
Yeah, they did. I wanted to mention about pardons. That's something I was hoping you could ask Mr. Dean this question. But anyway, talking about leaving aside for the moment the definition of what Obama meant when he said egregious as far as crimes by the Bush administration or acts of commission or omission, I would say that the more important thing is to what's going to prevent, I'll invert my question actually to what might usually be asked, I will say what's going to stop Bush from pardoning everyone. And these will be, at least for the federal crimes, you know.
Yeah.
And what,
there's nothing to stop him, Prez. I can tell you that. We don't need John Dean to tell you that. Constitution, this is the one kingly power that was left in the Constitution. It was the most, arguably, one of the most hotly contested things during the Constitution.
I have an addendum for that question, though, Tom, if
Go
I might.
Go for it.
What would prevent Bush from resigning and Cheney pardoning him?
Technically nothing, but I think that his pride and his wanting to have a place in history would prevent him from doing it. I think his personality is what would prevent him from doing it.
Well, we still lose all the other guys, though. And if we another question I had real quickly. If they start impeachment hearings, I mean, it's still not too late to begin them. And once they're begun, is it not true that there's no more pardon?
That's right. He can't pardon himself.
I've been trying to, and he
can't pardon anybody who's involved in the crimes that are associated for which he's been impeached.
I left this message with Conyers several times, and he had a response to a question in an interview.
Well, I think, you know, when Congress comes back, and thank you, Prez, you raise a really good point, and this is one that I feel very strongly about. After the election, Congress is going to come back into session in, as I recall, December for a week or two, and then there's the Christmas recess, and then that's the end of this Congress. And when they come back into session, I believe that they should start impeachment hearings. And they should do it to satisfy that constitutional gotcha, as it were, that says that a president cannot pardon any member. You know, he can't use the pardon power when he's under impeachment. And, you know, for things that have to do with the impeachment. And it's, in fact, let's see here. It's Article 2. Here it is right here. The president, vice president, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanor. Oh, no, that's not the one it is. But in any case, the bottom line is that impeachment is the one big caveat. And if he is under indictment for impeachment, it severely limits his pardon powers, and I think it's an important thing. It's Cheryl in Portland. We just have a half a minute, Cheryl, before we have to wrap up the hour. You get the last word.
Okay, just really quickly. It strikes me as odd that the evangelical body within the Republican group is so up in arms about this, quote, trickle-down stuff, when the Bible is full of admonition toward the rich in terms of their responsibility for the poor. I mean, Jesus got killed for trying to push those kinds of agendas, you know? So I just think it's weird that no one's talking about that.
Yeah, Jesus was a socialist. Cheryl, thank you. Well said. It is a problem. It is a tough one, and I don't think the Republican Party is ever going to deal with it well. Tomorrow, Dan Gaynor, VP of Business and Media Institute, he says the Nobel Prize for Economics was given to Paul Krugman for Bush bashing and nothing else. Yeah, right. And the Honorable Madeleine Albright will drop by. Remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. It all starts with each one of us. Getting out there, getting active. It's not enough to just vote. The hard work begins on Guy Fawkes Day, November 5th. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.